Protesters in Hong Kong have added another cause in their movement against China. The pro-democracy protesters took out a support rally for China's ethnic Uyghurs in Hong Kong's financial district.
Thousands of protesters gathering in front of Taiwan's legislature. It's the third protest this week, and many more people are expected to arrive throughout the day.
Hi there, and thanks for listening. If you're enjoying our podcast and have a recommendation about someone you think we should have on to share their voice and journey with the world, by all means, let us know. It could be an aid worker, monastic, author, journalist, doctor, resistance leader, really anyone with some tie or another to the ongoing situation in Myanmar or anything related to its history or culture. To offer up a name, go to our website, insightmyanmar.org, and let us know. But for now, just sit back and take a listen to today's episode.
This is Yi, your host for this episode for the Inside Myanmar podcast. Today we are joined by Lorraine Pan. Lorraine's pronouns are they, them. So Lorraine is a student, writer, activist, and also an artist. Both Lorraine and I have like a similar journey of leaving our respective countries. So for Lorraine, it's China, and for me, to Myanmar. And we both came to the West with the pursuit of an education. And I left Myanmar when I was 17 and came to the United States. I had my bachelor degrees in communications media. Lorraine grew up in China and came to University of Toronto, Canada. And she's currently pursuing her bachelor's degree in women and gender studies. Welcome to our podcast, Lorraine. And could you tell us, share us your journey and your decision to come study in Canada after growing up in China?
I was born in a very small town in China, and I grew up there until I was 18. When I was in high school, I went through the COVID 3 years in China, and at that time I had some mental issues. I'm also a neurodivergent person, but I was undiagnosed as an autistic person at that time. The small town that I was born was really traditional and conservative. The neurodivergent people and the disabled people are usually discriminated as lazy people. So when I was in high school, I was criticized by the teacher a lot. At first, I really thought that it was my own issue. But later, I realized this is a whole systemic thing. I started to talk about policies and the laws in China. And I also focus on politics, including what was happening in Hong Kong at that time. Because 2019, that was my... I was just starting my high school journey, so the revolution in Hong Kong really impacted me a lot. So during my high school years, I realized that I could not stay in China anymore because I really want to do the activism I want to write more articles about what is happening in China. And I realized that it would be too dangerous for me to stay in China if I want to do activism. So I decided to leave China. Fortunately, I got an offer from a university in Canada. So I left China after graduating from high school.
The Hong Kong protests happened while you were still in high school. So you said that that is the pivotal moment for you in deciding that you want to leave China and pursue your education elsewhere. Where were you and how did you receive the news about the Hong Kong protests?
Well, I was really active on Chinese social media, so Weibo at that time. And we actually do have a very few people talking about Hong Kong on Weibo. Because of the censorship, so the posts are usually deleted by the platform immediately after they posted. But I still have the opportunity to check some posts sometimes. That's the main resources that I get news about Hong Kong at the time. I didn't know the firewall. I didn't know VPN. I didn't know other social medias like Twitter, Instagram that are banned in China. I only know Weibo, but luckily we do have some people talking about Hong Kong. And at that time, we also have some people talk about Thailand and Myanmar, and they are usually be connected as a milk tea allies. The interesting part is that there are two different people when in my following list. One type of people think that the issue in Myanmar, Thailand, and Hong Kong are the same, so we should support them all. But another type of person think that Hong Kong is different from other countries. Hong Kong should be a part of China, and what was happening in Hong Kong at that time was not accessible. So I started to try to understand what is the difference and what is the connection and why people feel they are different. Luckily, I met friends from Hong Kong at that time. He's a Hong Kongese, but now he's in US. So we talked about these issues, and I realized what I read in Chinese news are different from what is happening in Hong Kong. When I started to do my high school, we have two different classes. One is STEM classes and another one is social science and humanities. I chose the social science and humanities one. So we have a politics and history courses, but the STEM one doesn't have so many humanities and politics classes. And in China, the politics classes are usually taught to me how much should I love the Communist Party and how should I follow the government. And at that time, a good example that teacher always talked about is Hong Kong. My teacher always told me that Hong Kong should be a part of China, and those people who want to seek for Hong Kong independence are trying to ruin the Hong Kong. But I do have a friend participating in the movement, so I feel confused. And I was told that I probably can try to read some resources out of the Chinese social medias. So I tried to educate myself how to use VPN and how to read news that not written by Chinese social medias and Chinese news media. And I started to use VPN, to use Twitter and Instagram. And I met some new people online. They are from Hong Kong and Taiwan. We started to communicate. And I realized what I was learning for over 10 years are actually not the fact and the truth. So at that time, my life really had an important change. Also, That is actually a personal, that is an important point of my personal life, because I came to a high school that I didn't really want to go. I didn't get into the high school that I want to go. And in the high school that I didn't want to stay, I feel depressed. But at first, I thought that that was because I didn't get into the school that I want to go. So I think that's my personal issue. But I realized the whole system, whole education system is not friendly to people like me, because when I was in high school, I started to express my ideas as a queer person, as a bisexual person, as a non-traditional femme. And I do find that the environment in school is not friendly to me. So I started to understand more issues about LGBTQ community and I connected with what was happening in Hong Kong. So I realized, oh, this is not a place for me. That was a beginning.
Thank you for sharing that. There are so many threads that I'm interested in. First of all, what you said about Chinese news is a bit different than anywhere else. And then you coming to realization that it is only after you use VPN and connected to people online, you realize the kind of a bubble, I would say, that this Chinese Communist Party has put on. And I want to share a similar childhood, I would say, growing up in Myanmar under the dictatorship in the 1990s. In school too, our political, actually, like, there's no political science, but more like history, right? History lessons are usually told from the perspective of what the authoritarian regime wants the children, the students, to think. So it, and so you mentioned that your teacher in politics class would mention that Hong Kong should be part of China, but you don't agree with it. And when the Hong Kong movement happened, you connected with people and with the movement online. So tell us, for our listeners who have access to Facebook and Instagram without needing a VPN, what are the steps you need to surpass to be able to access the different information? And also, what is social media really like in China? I know that China has like their own version of different platform of social media. Can you tell us what really is like with a censorship and the amount of access that you get in terms of news in China?
Well, for example, I realized one thing impacted me a lot is that on Weibo, once I watched a video from People's Daily, that is an official newspaper of Chinese Communist Party, and that video is about Hong Kong movement. In that video, Hong Kong police hit Hong Kongese protest, and that video was played with exciting music, because they wanted to use the exciting music to praise the police, and I was a little bit scared because I can't believe that people can praise violence, because the very natural sound that come to my mind at that time is that no matter what political opinions you have, you should not be hit by officers. And that is not something should be praised. But in that video, the Hong Kongese protesters are being called out violent. And I was really confused because they do not have weapons. Police have weapons. People don't have weapons. Why do you call people as violent? Why don't you call the police who hit people are violent? Why do you call that is justice? the video is probably the same as some as another one. The video is probably the same one as what we say on Twitter or Facebook, but the description is from another narrative and a perspective, and you do feel that they try to convince you that what is the police doing is something accessible, but for me that is not accessible. Actually, at that time, I didn't know what did Hong Kongese people really want, and at that time, I didn't really know about Hong Kongese movement and history and politics, and I did not really know that why people came out to the street. But what I know at that time is that I know that anyone who expresses political ideas should not be treated in that way. And I was a little bit lucky because when I was in high school, around like 4 to 5 years ago, you can still vote. Well, I used an iPhone at that time, and you have Apple account to download application. I remember that it's not really hard to buy an account based in US or based in Hong Kong. You can just buy that on Chinese social medias. But I heard that when I left China, it is really hard to buy an account because all of the websites selling the foreign accounts are banned. So at the time, I just bought a US account for my Apple application store. And then I can download a VPN. But to purchase VPN service, it would be another issue because it's not really safe to use Chinese applications to pay for the service. But I did use Alipay to pay for the service. But it is actually not safe at all. And I was told later that a lot of VPNs are actually funded by Chinese companies. They actually can watch you, but they do not. They actually monitor you, but they don't do action to stop you if you don't do something really radical. You can still read information and contacts, but that's something 4 to 5 years ago. I think it would be much more strict today, because I was told it's not really possible to download VPN now because a lot of VPN are also banned in China. But when I was in high school, I can still get some services. So I use a VPN to download other applications like Instagram and Twitter. They are all available on Apple App Store. But if you are using Android, I think it would be more difficult to get access. I'm not sure if it is true. I didn't do the information check, but I was told that some applications, some social medias are banned in Apple App Store in China now. But when I was in high school, I could still download them.
So for you to do activism or do research online, you had to use VPN to surpass different, firewalls and to conceal your identity. So were there any Chinese protests on the street, or were they more like conversation online?
It's a little bit hard for me to talk about these issues because the thing is that I was born in a very, very small town. We don't really have many people. And my town, the town that I was born is officially called a poor area in China. So the resources that we can get are actually very, very limited. especially when I was in high school, I feel really isolated because I can't reach out to people who have the same ideas as mine. But after I left China and met different activist friends from China, I was told that there were some activism in China before. For example, I do have some friends who came to the street to support feminism against gender-based violence in China. But when I was in high school, I had no idea about those protests. Apparently, those movements are very limited. It would not be so many people as what happened in Hong Kong before. But I would say that there are some people doing activism in China. And also, how do we define activism? For me, activism is not only about a movement and a rally. I know some people, they organize a very small gathering, for example, documentation screening or fundraising for Hong Kong or something. Those things would be really dangerous in China, but I know some people did those things in China in a very secret way because we do have a small circle and sometimes we try to use different words to avoid the censorship. Because you mentioned that how do we talk about these things on Chinese social media? I would say that you can't directly say Hong Kong. You can't directly say 2019 protest. You need to use some other words. For example, you use a word with a similar pronunciation, or you use different symbols to describe those things. But people can still find each other. But I didn't find my group when I was in high school. I know it later. I know it after I left China.
You grew up in a small town, and that being isolated from the big city probably gave you a different perspective on life in China. How did you realize, like, Canada or like University of Toronto is the place you want to go and study? And then did you always know you wanted to study women and gender studies?
Well, it's a little bit tricky because I think I'm 21 now and I'm not determined enough to tell you what I want to do in the future. But I think it's okay because I'm still very young. But on the other hand, it's not really okay because I'm a person with a lot of marginalized identities. I have to immigrate, I have to settle down, I have financial issues. I really need to decide what I want to do in the future, but it's a little bit hard. So actually, the reason I chose Canada was really simple. At that time, I thought I have to leave China and I only speak English. I can't come to non-English countries. So I think, okay, here are some options: Australia, New Zealand, the UK, US, Canada. And I think Canada is the most immigrant-friendly country compared to other countries. Well, there are many issues in Canada, but Canada is still a little bit better than other countries, so I chose Canada. And I was not at University of Toronto at the very beginning. It would be another long story that I applied to Canadian universities in May 2022. That was actually very late to apply because most of the people apply in December last year, but I applied in May. So there were not many options, and I chose some university that still accepted students, and I got my offer. But here was another story that I did not get my study visa in time because that was 2022, the COVID just ended. the immigrant office was still not really efficient. So I took another year to come to University of Toronto, and I bought my major. When I chose my major, I didn't really think about my future. I was a little bit childish. I was thinking that, oh, that was something that I want to do. So I just chose that major. And at first, I was doing double major in comparative literature and gender studies. But later, I dropped comparative literature and doing the specialist in women and gender studies. And I have to say that that actually caused some problems. Because I need to take more courses to graduate, which gives me a lot of pressure. And I know many people, they are worried about jobs after graduation. So do I. But I know at the very beginning, because I know that a lot of people who graduated from humanities and social science majors don't know how to get a job. And when I chose the women and gender study, I thought I want to do feminism research work. So I chose that major. And at the time, I knew that it would be possible for me to be jobless after graduating. So I came to different workshops about seeking a job. Or I come to different people to ask them that, what do you do after graduation? So I prepared to find a job that not related to my major. But it also took me another year to make sure that I actually want to do academic work. So I'm planning to apply to graduate school this December. But I didn't realize that I want to do academic work in the very beginning. It took me quite a time. And if you ask me that if I am really determined to do academic work, I would say I'm not pretty sure. Not because I'm not into academic work enough. It's because there are a lot of reality issues. I have financial issues, I have family responsibility, I have to immigrate to secure my studies. So I have to think about if I should find a proper job, proper and stable job first, or I choose not really stable life to do my PhD program immediately. Or if I really want to do PhD program, I really want to do it now or several years later. I haven't decided yet. On the one hand, I feel I'm just 21. I have time to think about it. On the other hand, I feel, oh, I have to do the decision immediately. But if you really ask me, I would say I still have the confusion, but I'm trying my best to figure out.
Of course. I understand that you are naturally drawn to studying for marginalized people, since you growing up in China, you were neurodivergent and also queer, and growing up in this kind of environment, did you find other people in person who are of the similar interests and ideas as you, or is it more online that you found your tribe in trying to expand your ideas and thoughts moving forward?
I actually find my community in person. I used to be really active on social medias. I used to have 10,000 followers on Twitter, but I deleted my account later. I got a lot of harassment and threats. I don't really think that I can handle those things, so I chose to leave social medias. But in reality, I still do some activism work. Sometimes I do public speech. Sometimes I do more behind the scenes. And I get to know some people who also care about marginalized people. And one of the most important things for me is that I have a community focusing on transnational activism, because I'm a person with transnational experiences. So I focus on more about transnational activism. How do you connect to Asia and North America? How do you connect to East and West? How do you connect to issues in Hong Kong, Taiwan, and Myanmar with the issue in North America, for example, Black Lives Matter, Stop Asian Hate, and Indigenous Justice? I think those issues are connected. Luckily, I have some people in North America. They are first-generation immigrant or migrant, so we have similar experiences. I also meet some friends in Taiwan and South Korea that are focusing on transnational activism, especially last week, I went to the platform, I went to an event organized by the Platform C. Platform C is a Korean-based organization focusing on transnational activism, connecting with Myanmar, Thailand, and Hong Kong, which touches me a lot, because I think a lot of times, a lot of communities based in national identities are actually a little bit xenophobia or isolating. I can understand that. It is totally understandable because you need a security-based mortal identity, and usually that identity is nationality. But I would say that it's more important to find people who have the same values. I have a friend from Myanmar, and she told me that, Lorraine, you do care about Myanmar. And I'm really touched because a lot of people in Myanmar don't really care about these issues as you do. And I told her that, yes, I think because we have the same values and we live under the same struggle, because my home country, China, is arming the military in Myanmar. So what I feel is what you are feeling. And I think it's important to connect us to be against the violence and together. There must be a lot of people who come from China and now living in North America. We do have the same national identities, but we don't share anything in common because we have different values. For me, it's more important to connect the people who have same values instead of the same identities. On the other hand, individuals can be really different from another individual in the movement, because like you and me must be really different, not only because you were born in Myanmar and I was born in China, but also because we are different generations. I'm a little bit younger and we have other different identities. For example, I self-identify as a disabled person. Those are different. Those makes us have different experiences, but that doesn't stop us from working together. We can be really different, but we can still work for the same goal. And I feel really lucky to meet people like you, like other people in my community. We probably focus on different things. For example, I do focus on Myanmar, but I focus on more Hong Kong more than Myanmar. We have different directions, but we can work together. I think that's important. And that's a really strong backup of mine, because whenever I feel politically depressed, I know there are some people who can relate to me, and I know who I can reach out.
Some people would put like Hong Kong and Taiwan in one bucket in terms of transnational solidarity, right? Like in Milk Tea Alliance, it's not just Hong Kong and Taiwan, but there's Thailand and Myanmar. as well. But I understand when you say about like bunching things together because of the obvious connection with China, with Hong Kong and Taiwan, and then Myanmar and Thailand seems slightly further away. With that, you talk about value-based connection when we do activism. And instead of connecting based on identity, it's based on your values and ideas of what you believe in. And I think that is very strong in Milk Tea Alliance. These youths especially are from various different backgrounds, but they are driven by the same things. And in terms of pro-democracy movement, and I think everybody is learning from each movement. I noticed that when the Myanmar pro-democracy movement broke out after the 2021 election, people are sharing information online about how to prepare and protect yourself from this model of tear gas, because the other protests has broke out in Hong Kong and Taiwan before. So we can all learn from each other. And then with pop culture reference and online community, it has helped each other in moving forward in activism. With your connection with Myanmar, and I know that you said that you're more focused on Hong Kong, but what kind of activism or the threat that ties between transnational solidarity between these countries?
I actually also care about the LGBTQ community in Myanmar, and I think activists have already been marginalized under the military government, and LGBTQ people who have another marginalized identities are facing more threats. So I focus on more people who have more than one marginalized identity. And I connected different countries together when the people have other same marginalized identities, for example, LGBTQ identity. And I realized a thing, how do you say? For example, I am living in Toronto now, and I think it's really important for me to acknowledge this is Indigenous people's land. Although Indigenous justice is not my main focus. And I think I have the same responsibility to address Myanmar's issue, because the government in my home country is arming the military in Myanmar. So for me, that is a very natural thing. And also that is a very natural thing for me to connect Hong Kong and Taiwan, because the government in my home country is controlling Hong Kong and is trying to control the Taiwan. So from my perspective, those things are really connected. But I also know there are some people don't really care about other communities. For example, in Chinese communities, some Chinese dissidents don't really talk about Myanmar, Thailand, because they think that's something that are far away from from our community. But I do believe that the connection between two governments in China and Myanmar make the system more hard to challenging. You must realize the connection between these two governments, and then you can do the next reaction to be against them. And to be against them, it's really important to connect with other people who live in the same struggle, but in different ways. Because different perspectives from different people give you another idea of the direction of activism. But if you only focus on your identity, it would be really easy to be isolated. That's the first reason. And another reason is that some community with only one single marginalized identity are easy to fall into the trap of internal colonization. For example, within the Chinese dissident community, there are some cases about sexual harassment. And I think that's because gender issues are not addressed by the community. But gender issue is an important issue in activism, same as other issues like LGBTQ issues and disabled issues, etc. And I think making a transnational connection avoids you to fall into the internal colonization, because you do have other perspectives. For example, I learn a lot from people in Myanmar. For example, because gay rights are not guaranteed in Myanmar, and in the protest movement in Myanmar, LGBTQ community go to the street as well, because LGBTQ rights is a part of the democracy. And advocating for LGBTQ community is a way to call for democracy. It is important to connect with other communities so that you won't fall into another type of nationalism, to be against one nationalism. That's my view.
For the LGBTQ rights, in Taiwan, they already have the same-sex marriage legalized in 2019. And with that, I would say that tips the dominoes into getting positive effects in Thailand for legalizing same-sex marriage in this year, 2025. But in countries like Myanmar, which is traditionally very conservative, and also, although they fight for democracy, sometimes these issues of marginalized people, like LGBTQ, disabled people, or diverse ethnic background people, are usually not at the forefront of the conversation. And sometimes it is being thought as, oh, we need to get economy and democracy, get it right first. We need to get rid of the military regime first before we can talk about these marginalized issues. What do you think about this kind of narrative? And then you mentioned that fighting for LGBT rights are fighting for democracy. Can you expand on that?
Oh, you mentioned those description, I really hate it, because I feel when I participated in activism organized by Chinese dissidents, there is always a voice that we have a more important goal to achieve first. We need democracy first. We need human rights first, and then we talk about women's rights. I would like to ask a question. I always want to ask those people, what's your imagination of democracy? If there is a country that women's rights cannot be guaranteed, do you really think that human rights can be guaranteed? Do you really think that women's rights is a part of human rights? If you think so, why do you think that advocating for women's rights is separated people? Why don't you think that advocating for women's rights is a part of advocating for human rights? Why don't you think that advocating for LGBTQ community is a part of advocating for democracy? Because those issues exist. As I mentioned, that sexual harassment does happen in activism movement. If you think that that is something can be sacrificed when you want to pursue a more important goal, for example, democracy. For example, some people think that, oh, we need human rights in China first, and then we talk about women. If you talk about sexual harassment in activism, you are trying to separate people. You want us not to be united. Then you make women in activism more marginalized. Denying the factor of sexual harassment, talking about the serious issue in activism does not separate anyone. But if you deny the serious issue in activism, you make some specific people more marginalized. You are actually separating people. You are actually making women feel less secure in activism, so that an important part of the activism, women, are actually might be more marginalized and cannot advocate for democracy. The thing is that even within the same dissident community, there are still some people who are more marginalized, and there are some people who are less marginalized. And I think it's, for example, I'm a Han Chinese, and I do have privilege compared to people who are Uyghurs and Tibetans. Admitting that I have Han privilege does not deny my marginalized identities as a Chinese dissident. And also, being a Chinese dissident does not erase my privilege and advantages as a Han Chinese person. It is not only happening in China, also in Western society, that I do have more voices compared to Uyghur people and Tibetan people, because Han Chinese is also the majority of immigrants. So we are more invisible. It doesn't make me less marginalized because I still have a lot of vulnerable identities. But my vulnerable identities cannot erase my privilege. And I have to admit that so that I can advocate for them as well. And admitting my advantage does not mean to make myself guilty. Admitting my advantages is to make myself recognize that I have a voice for other people. And if you do not recognize this issue, you hurt people. You hurt people. I think it's really important to address that internal colonization does exist. And it won't disappear if you don't talk about these issues. These things would be more tough if you choose to ignore them. And I think LGBTQ community is a really important, it's a very important group to be united with. And how do you unite with LGBTQ community, advocate for LGBTQ community? I found an interesting thing that a lot of people think that if you talk about a women's right, you talk about LGBTQ community, you get over attention and we pay less attention to the main goal, democracy. But why don't we think about another way? If LGBTQ community and women's rights is an important part of democracy, when we are doing activism for LGBTQ community, we are advocating for democracy in our own way. You probably have other main folks. But say, you won't say that I separate people if I focus more on Hong Kong. And I will not say that you separate people if you focus more on Myanmar. So when we talk about LGBTQ people, that's actually the same. I wouldn't think that anyone who advocates for LGBTQ community make me pay less on pay less attention on democracy. And I know it's really inspiring that we say Taiwan and Thailand legalized gay marriage, but I would say we can dream bigger. We want more. I want that to happen in Myanmar too. I don't know if I can say that before I die, but I will advocate for that because that's something that I dream for and I want that to come true. Like for example, like this month, Hong Kong proposes the legal recognition for same-sex couples registered overseas. And some people think this is a small progress, but I feel why the same-sex couples have to register overseas. Why can't they just do that in Hong Kong? I want more. So I always say that we can have more. People think that we have a bigger issue, but we can't. But why can't we have both? I want a country make me feel secure, not only for criticizing the government freely, but also be recognized as a queer formally. I think that's important. I want both, and I will advocate for both.
You mentioned the priorities of issues that some majority Chinese protester or different activism groups have it, like the question of like which issue is more of a priority and which issues are not so much priority that you could probably work on it later on when we get quote-unquote democracy. So where I'm going with this is like for different movements in Hong Kong and Taiwan, and also like in the most recent movements, it has become more of a leaderless movement, right? It's more a collective people, usually students or youths organizing in their own ways. And then the reason it becomes leaderless is for the safety issue, right? If you have a leader and if you're super visible and you can be surveilled, you can be monitored, and they could target to the leader of the movement, and that could die, the movement could die with the leader. But recently we have seen these floods of protesters, millions of them participating in different movements that are very effective. With that, the leaderless to the public, but is there a hierarchy of like who determine which issues are worth pursuing? Do you think there's like a different privileged group of people that has more say in determining which issues we should go for as a movement?
I think decentralization is an important point in movement. I actually prefer a leaderless movement. When I was still really active on social media, I know some people think that I am a leader activist, also because I did some public speech, but I never thought that I was a leader. I'm just someone participating in activism, and I think people who do more behind-the-scenes work are same important. But I would say some people are more visible and some people are not. And sometimes being more visible is a privilege and an advantage because apparently I get more people heard me compared to people who are still in China. But I wouldn't say that my voice is more important than them, and I wouldn't say that I am more correct than them. It's just because I am luckier to be here to talk with you, while some people cannot. I think if we want to get more if we want to call for more people for the activism, it's important to work with people who have different opinions and different ideas and who do activism in different directions. In protesting in Hong Kong, so many people go out to the street. There are different streams, different organizations, different people have different opinions. I would say that anyone is more important than anyone. We all together make this come true. And I still don't really like people who want to be leaders. There are some activists in movements want to be the leaders, but I think decentralization is important because a movement following one person can't be a movement with many people that we want. We want a movement following a specific value, not a movement following a specific person.
I see a shift in terms of democracy movements in Myanmar. Before, when Aung San Suu Kyi was the icon and the leader of the people, and everybody, mostly, towards the end, it becomes like more nationalists. Older generation people are diehard Aung San Suu Kyi fan. And so although she was being not so likable person in international media, when domestically with people in the country, she is very well loved. And even now in jail, people still haven't forgotten about her, pushing for her release. And when she was campaigning for 2020 election, there was a controversy between her opinions on Rohingya Muslim community and her stance on it. And while the international community might criticize her for it, domestically, Myanmar nationalists are still loving her and supporting her. And when the 2021 coup happened, and most of the people who went out to protest are also the same people, but also from different diverse community, like LGBTQ, disabled people, and also people from various backgrounds. But most importantly, we notice a majority of Gen Z and youths participating in it. So from there, because of the safety issue, the movement, like now 4 or 5 years after the coup, you know, the movement still take on in different forms because young people in the country, most of them have to leave the country because of the conscription law, because they don't want to fight in the military's army. They ended up leaving. So it becomes youth in exile pushing the Spring Revolution movement after the coup. So I can see the progression between the leader-led movement to what it has transformed into leaderless movement, or like many leaders, like people are the leader, like people-driven movement. So with that, like, I think with the Spring Revolution, the youth are connected, although they are apart geographically. The ties that bring the youth together are usually online and in pop culture. And I feel like people from older generation don't understand the importance of the online presence and the connection that the youth have. So can you explore more on that topic of how, you figuring out different ideas while you were situated in China, where I suppose like people around you of people older generation maybe not share the same ideas with you, or would they say like it is your ideas are more progressive ideas compared to other people of different generation in China?
Well, we do have a lot of arguments all the time, and it hurted. I still cannot go through some arguments in the past. I would like to say that sometimes it's understandable that we put some expectation to some specific people and we call them leaders. But in recent years, I realized that you put the wrong expectation to other leaders. It's also really easy to get disappointed when they do something that different from your value. For example, older generation activists think that I'm too progressive and radical. Or some older activists think that women should shut up because democracy, politics, and activism are a man's thing. I'd say that the more arguments that I have with other people, actually I'm more determined to realize that what I really want to do. To imagine a democracy that I want, it must be based in racial equity and gender equity. If you want a democracy that you want, you can criticize politicians freely, but you still want to control women, and you still think that women are property of yours, then we defend the different democracy, and that's not the democracy in my eyes. Those type of people, I want to work with them because there are some values same as democracy and activism in my mind, racial equity and gender equity. But there are also some people that who have a slightly different from my, for example, we probably have the same values, but we probably have different directions to work. And we have arguments, and that hurt. That hurts because we know that we both care about the movement, and we both put a lot of effort into it. But because we have different opinions, so we can't work together. I would say it's still important to have a conversation, even though sometimes there are some arguments, because if we keep silent, we would feel more uncomfortable. It's important to speak out. And I'm still learning how to avoid arguments with other people. But I would say that people can work on different directions. If we really kind of work together, we just work in our own way. I respect your work, but I also respect my mind to work in my way. I still think that it's important to talk with older generation, and I do have a lot of friends who are older than me but respect me very much. And I also learn a lot from their experiences because apparently I'm still figuring out my own way. And it's really important for me to learn from other people who are older than me. But here are two things that we need to recognize. One is the power dynamics. Sometimes older people have more voices because, as I mentioned, they are more advantaged, not because they are more character. We need to recognize that. Second, respect each other. I do think that I need to learn more from people who are older because they have more experiences, but I do recognize that I have my own value and I'm not less worthy than other people who are older than me. So in the conversations, I also share my opinions. Maybe not they are not mature enough, but older people can have immature ideas as well. We just talk and we find a way to work together. Sometimes we keep differences, sometimes we change for each other, but respect and a conversation is the secret to work together. Sometimes if it really doesn't work out, that's okay, but do not lose the determination, I would say.
Mm. Are they open to discussing, communicating with your rebuttal on their arguments, or more of the older activist community, do they tend to shut down and saying, or like attacking your age or your gender?
I think it actually really depends on people. I was at a platform seeing Sower several days ago, and one activist just said, we're doing the introduction, and one activist started to say, oh, I started to do the work 22 years ago. And I was like, oh my God, I am not even 22 years old. We really have an age gap, but I had a really wonderful conversation with them, and I really want to visit Platform C again, perhaps next time if I have another opportunity to come to Korea. There are some people who are older than me. We can still work together. And also, actually, most of the friends are older than me. I have no idea that why my activist friends are always like 30s or 40s. And I'm 21. I'm still very young. But they always respect my opinions. And I don't feel that I'm less worthy because of my age when I talk to them. But there are also some people who are in the same age as mine, but don't really respect others. So I think it actually really depends on people. I wouldn't say older people are just more annoying or something. I don't think so. I don't think age or generation is an issue. I think different ages and different generation offers different narratives and perspectives in the conversation. I think it's actually, I'm actually more positive to talk with people from other ages and other genders or from other places, actually.
Mm. You grew up in China and then you left in 2023 to come to Canada. Would you say that your thoughts and ideas, or like how you present yourself, is representative of the Chinese youth right now? Like people your age, are they more like you? Are they less like you? Or are they also equally opinionated about different ideas that they have?
I'm not sure if my words count because I only talk to people who have the same values with me. But I do have many friends who are in the same age as mine and who come from China do express a lot about the politics and activism. And I'm lucky enough to have many friends who come from China to Canada participating the protest with me, so I don't feel alone. But there are still some people around me who in my age and come from China don't really talk about these issues and don't really care. But I choose to work with people who do the same thing. But I think here's the issue is that a lot of people in my community feel insecure, so they tend to do more behind the scenes work. For example, I'm very determined not to go back to China, so I am determined to show up every protest. But I do have some friends, they have more concerns. Some of my friends do come back to China sometimes. Some of my friends don't come back to China, but they have other concerns that they should not be in very high key. So they do more behind the scenes works, for example, organizing the events or do banners, or they write articles, but they don't use their own name. They probably have another nickname for their writings. I just think there are many people in my age come from China, do activism, but they are not usually recognized.
Mm. You said you're determined to not to go back to China and to pursue different activism that you are putting your effort in. How is it for somebody who grew up in China with, you said you're Han Chinese, so in a homogenous population, everybody look like you and speak your language, to from that to coming to Canada, where not everybody look like you or understand, even the same people who come from the same country as you probably don't share the same ideas. So how is that shift from growing up in China to coming to Canada?
Well, it is so tough. When I was in China, I was a majority. I suddenly came to Canada. I feel I'm minority most of the time. However, even when I was in China, even my race is a majority of China, I still feel I'm minority in other aspects. For example, I'm disabled. For example, my autism was not recognized formally before. For example, I am LGBTQ person, and in China, LGBTQ community are not recognized. But in Canada, I actually find more LGBTQ communities, find more disabled communities, and I find more people who have different racial identities but have other same identities as mine. So I don't really feel lonely most of the time, but I do understand the feeling of being a migrant and being a person of color. I still can't go through with it. I still feel that I'm really different from other people, but that's not because of I am a Chinese or I am an Asian. It's more because I'm first generation immigrant. I don't think people who are second generation or third generation have the same feeling as mine. I feel more confused because of in-betweeners. I do have experiences in China, and I am living in Canada. One important thing is that when I come to other countries or cities, people ask me where you're coming from. And I don't really know how to answer that question. For example, when I was in Seoul, people asked me, where do you do activism? Well, and where are you from? Well, I do activism in Toronto, but I'm not a Canadian. I was not born in Canada. But I kind of say that I come from China because I don't do activism in China. So I always explain a lot. And living in Canada does make me feel isolated sometimes, because it's hard to find people like me. But I don't really feel secure in China either. So that kind of feeling, I feel must be something that I have to go through for my whole life. So I just accepted that. It's just the loneliness in China becomes another type of loneliness. But it can't be solved if I come back to China. It will exist because I choose this way to live my own life. I do feel lonely a lot of time. But I was lonely when I was in China as well. I think that's just because I chose my value in a very tough times, and I accepted that.
The way that you are being viewed in China versus the way that you are being viewed as a self-identity in Canada, has that shifted? Because in China, I know that there are other things that you identify yourself, but from the superficial point of view, if somebody just look at you and speak to you in Chinese, when you were growing up in a small town in China versus in Canada, where, you know, people see you, your race first, and then the way you present yourself first. And then would that have you notice a shift in perspective about yourself? I mean, for the context, I grew up in Myanmar until I was 17. And then I decided to come to America to study. And that was in 2011. And instead of going to study in a big city in America, I went to a very small town called Lynchburg in Virginia. The school that I went is a liberal arts college, so it's small, very diverse. People are more or less accepting, and there is a lot of international students. So maybe like 10% of the student population or 5% is international students. So people are not so strangers to seeing Asian students or Asian youth. But when I go out in town in Lynchburg, I feel like people are not aware of what kind of Asian I am. So they would not know, like when I talk about, of course, they would ask me where I'm from. Why is my English so good? Did I learn back home? So those are the top three questions I get asked. So when I say I'm from Burma or Myanmar, more often than not, people don't know where it is. So then I get assumed that I'm either Chinese or Korean because, you know, Lynchburg has a lot of Korean-American Christian population. And on top of it, another major university in Lynchburg is Liberty University, which is very conservative and very Christian. They are gun friendly, but not queer friendly kind of community. So it was very jarring for me to not have my privilege of looking like everybody, speaking like everybody, and then from a majority looking and acting, speaking person in my home country, in my home city, to coming to America and suddenly becoming a minority presenting, I would say. Like, you just look like, I just look like a minority, no matter how other parts of me that I identify myself seems to take a secondary role. So I notice a shift in how I present myself in terms of trying to explain myself in what type of Asian or what kind of thing I'm studying. So, you know, I see your journey coming from China, growing up in China, and then to be in Canada. And also because you're doing this activism work that make you stand on a different end of what your home country standpoint officially. So that also creates a different kind of perspective in your case. So how are you adjusting being in a different kind of society in Canada?
I feel what you said. I feel every word of yours. People always ask me that, where are you from? Where are you really from? And why do you speak a good English? How do you learn that? When do you start to learn English? And although China is a country that is more recognized, but because I was from a very small town, so people ask me where are you from? And I said China, and people are like, which city? And I said my city's name. No one knows. People expected you to say Shanghai, Beijing, but I was not from a big city. And no one really knows my city. And I really hope people do know that Chinese people can be really different from Chinese people. Because when people say, oh, yes, I came to China once, China is like blah, blah, I have no idea what they are talking about. And even Chinese people may not really know the city I was born because China is really big. And also, my mother tongue is not Mandarin or Cantonese. People are like, what language do you speak? And I say my language and no one really knows. I have to explain. And I have to explain that well did I learn English. And I think that's something that we have to face as an Asian. Because I do have a friend. She's an Eastern Asian. And she was not born in an English country. But to some reasons, her first language is English because she accepted English education since she was very, very little. But she was being asked that question all the time, why do you learn a good English? Why? Because that's her first language. That thing happens all the time. And I feel I'm foreigner everywhere. In North America, I have an Asian face. So I don't belong to North American. And even there's no difficulty for me to speak English. But you do feel that I have an accent. I'm not a native speaker. But in countries like Korea and Taiwan, the majority is Eastern Asian. I'm still a foreigner. Like in South Korea, I don't speak Korean. In Taiwan, my Mandarin it's different from Taiwanese Mandarin. And I don't have living experience in South Korea and Taiwan. So I feel like I'm still a foreigner. But I also know if I come back to China now, I will still feel I'm a foreigner. Because I don't share karma in most of the... I don't share karma with most of the Chinese people in China. So... I look like a minority in Western society, but even in Asian society, probably I don't really look like a minority, but I do feel I'm a minority. When I was in Korea, actually some people thought I was a Korean, so they naturally speak a Korean to me. And then I said, oh, I don't speak Korean. It's like people don't think that I look like a minority, but I know myself is not a majority here. And I always feel like I don't belong to anywhere. Of course, though, the way the forms are different when I come to Canada from China. But I think the root is the same. The reason of this feeling is the same, is that I just don't have I'm just not rooted in this place. I'm just a person with transnational experiences. So that's something that I have to experience. So I just accept that, though I don't really want.
The transnational experience, I also relate to that. Being away from home, you said that you don't go back to China, but since I've left Myanmar, I have gone back many times until the recent coup in 2021. So the feeling of leaving home, it's painful and you carry with you all the time. And the thought of returning home excites you, but also terrifies you sometimes, that a lot have changed and a lot have moved on. So to think about that, about our home country, is the immigrant feelings that people hold on to. And most people, well, the people who have the privilege of not having to leave their home for the pursuit of something else, either opportunity or outlook, or because you must leave, it's something that I think everybody who leave home carry with you, wherever you go, with a transnational experience.
I feel that way. I meet some friends from China, from the city close to my city, and they talk about their life there, and I realized, oh, that place really changes a lot. And I just met another friend several days ago. She came to the city I was born, and she took some pictures and posted it on social media, and I was like, oh, is that the city I was born? Because things change so much. There are more and more buildings, and the roads changed a lot. Like, I care about the hometown, my hometown, and I care about the policies, I care about the laws. I read the news about China every single day, but I don't live there anymore. And I believe that even you come back sometimes, you don't live there. That's not the main place that you are living with. So your experiences must be different from other people living in your hometown. That's just something that I have to go through with. Like, in a lot of time in Western society, not only in Canada, I also came to US. I feel like I immigrant to here, even I become a Canadian or US citizen, I will always feel this is not my home. I just escape from my home to here. I was forced to be here. It's not my choice to be here. But I also know that if I come back to my home, that won't be my home either. And I don't belong to the home that I was born either. That's a really tough thing, but I have to go through with it because I really love the place I was born. That sounded a little bit ridiculous because I love the home that I was born, so I left my home, but that is true. I have to leave. I have to be away from my home because I really care about my home. And leaving my home is the only way that I can keep caring for my home. It's the only way that I can keep speaking out about my home. And I feel, oh, I'm only 21, but I'm going to face it for my whole life. That sounds a little bit scary, but I choose it. That's a part of my responsibility, and I think that's a responsibility of a generation, because we are first generation immigrant. We just have to go through that. I have some friends, they are second generation, and they care about China. They are Chinese Canadians, but their views are different because their home is Canada. They care about another home, probably, but they do have some place make them feel security. And they are like us. They are second generation. They are still facing the questions like, where are you from? Why do you speak good English? But in their heart, they know that Canada is their home. But Canada is not my home. Even in the future, I become a Canadian citizen. Even probably in the future, I will speak a good English with a Canadian accent. It doesn't make me more Canadian. I know it.
I relate to your words as a first-generation immigrant to United States as well. I think most people, I guess like most Americans, feel the level of isolation only during the pandemic, because the majority of Americans don't own a passport or travel or live elsewhere to seek for opportunity or because they must leave. So I think that kind of resonated with them. In the pandemic was something that brought a lot of people closer in isolation. But also with that, with the pandemic, it comes from these different slurs of how the COVID virus started from China, or this Asian hate that kind of circulated in major cities in America, New York, DC, different towns, about if you're an Asian person, especially if you're a Chinese person, this they take this opportunity to talk about how, you know, Wuhan virus or different names in blaming China for the beginning of the virus. But how is it different in where you are in Toronto in terms of Asian hate? Or is it just an America thing, that kind of discrimination or some kind of snarky comments? Not, I wouldn't say like I have experienced like major, like spit in my face kind of experience, but there is like a bit of subtle, I guess, discrimination because of my race. But I think it is less so in Washington, D.C., because it is such a international city. But I can speak for the rest of America. But when I was a journalist of VOA, I have to report many news on Asian hate in different cities in America. So I was wondering if that's a similar thing in Canada as well, since you came there after the pandemic.
Well, apparently, it is not only an American thing, sadly. I do have one time come to a rally to support transgender people with my friend, and really have some people point out to me and my friends to say, go back to your country. And that's a reason that I want to address people who have more marginalized identities, because that happens in a rally supporting transgender people. So apparently people who are against us are both transphobic and racist. So on the one hand, they are against supports to transgender people. On the other hand, they use the racism words to be against us. And Canadian government is passing a bill against refugees and immigrants. The bill C2 basically gives the immigrant office a lot of power to reject or revoke anyone's visa without a reason, and also if it passes, people who enter to Canada over 1 year cannot claim as a refugee. But this is not reasonable, because apparently someone come to Canada, there are so many information barriers, language barriers. It's not really easy to get a lawyer or to know the processing within 1 year. Also, there is a possibility that when you come to Canada, your country is fine, but 1 year later, there's some issue in your country that happens. And I think, I remember that when Trump won the election this year, I told my friends that's a global political climate. That is not something only happening in US. And I told my friend at that time, what is happening in US may happen in Canada as well. I just don't know that things can change so much in a quick way that I cannot imagine. Because, like, the Liberal Party won the election in Canada, but the Liberal Party government is working with a Conservative Party to be against immigrants and refugees. That is actually really scary. And I also know my friend in Japan and South Korea and Europe don't live in a secure life. The right wing is rising everywhere, not only in Western society. But I also think that make us more united, because I have never been living in US. I only came there once. And I mean, I care about what is happening in US, but that is not my living experiences. But we do relate to each other. And you are not living in Canada, but I believe that you get my points.
Mm-hmm.
So we can connect to each other. Well, it's a little bit sad that we live in the same struggle, but yeah. It's also powerful that we can understand each other's struggle. I feel that way.
Yeah, I think the when you have this, so the as much as we have this conservative or like pushback right wing, and I think I notice a lot of xenophobic narrative underlying in a lot of major political figures, I would say, globally. So you're right in saying that it is a global phenomena. And I also realized that there is more like authoritarian style of governance rising in Southeast Asia and the rest of the world as well. I'm not sure whether that is what people favor, but enough people seem to enjoy it that even in countries that are supposedly have fair election, seem to have elected these kind of strong, masculine, more authoritarian style of governance and leader. Because I've been living in the United States since 2011, so it's been quite a while, and I have seen different progression of things, but in Washington, D.C., there are still different issues that are important to people. People are very global-minded. They're not just inward-looking into what is good for America, but looking at America as a superpower country that shapes the global politics and economy. And also the ideas that America blurred out, a lot of people in smaller countries take it quite literally. And China is also a superpower country. And, you know, my home country, Myanmar, the Myanmar military regime is close with China and Russia as well. And a lot of, I know that there's like some Chinese companies have always helped with the traffic monitoring or surveillance system in Myanmar, which raised the concern of cybersecurity and the level of surveillance that the government have on people. Did you notice anything like surveillance or monitoring when you were growing up in China? Although I know that you were quite young growing up in China and also a small town, but I'm not sure if that would be exactly the same as the level of traffic surveillance or any monitoring in a big city. But tell me more about your experience.
I think it's actually easier to monitor people like me in the small town, because in small town, you have less people, you have fewer people are using VPN or something. I didn't feel much when I was in high school, not because that didn't exist, only because I was lack of cautiousness about internet security. But I do know some people online. They I have some online friends when I was in China. I'm going to cry. We talk about Hong Kong, Myanmar, and Thailand. Sometimes, some of them just disappear. And I don't know if their account gets banned or they get arrested. Because I was lucky enough not to be arrested, and for one single time, I had never been arrested when I was in China, but my account on Chinese social media get banned all the time. So I just register a new account and get banned again. But sometimes when I talk with people, because it's really hard to reach out to people who have same opinions, because Chinese social media have censorship. So your posts are easily deleted by the platforms. So it's not really easy to reach out to people. So we take each other really seriously. And even though we have never met each other, we don't know each other's name, we don't know each other's face, we talk about and we share the same values. And sometimes they just disappear. I text to them, then they don't reply back, and they don't post it anymore. And I have no idea if they are in danger. But I could not do anything for them because I don't know their names. I don't know their faces. And it's really understandable that we don't know each other's name because we don't share the private information online. It's too dangerous, too risky. But it's also so scary. It's so scary. Someone just disappeared. Well, the best result is that their account just get banned. So they are probably still fine. But that's still so scary that your account get easily banned because of your speech. Because you hold different opinions from the government. Because I still feel when I was in high school, people on Chinese social media are really, they are not really radical. They tend to say that, well, I love my country, but there's some issues in my country, or well, I'm not going to be against the government, but the government can do better. Some of them are using this way to avoid censorship. Some of them really believe in that way, really believe that this is still a trustful country, but there are some issues that we could do better. But there's no difference for the platform. There's no difference for the authority. They just get banned. And sometimes you don't see them anymore. That was still a trauma for me, to be honest. That is actually a reason that I stopped using Chinese social media, not only because of my concerns about security. I really don't want to experience something like that again. I really don't want to make friends with someone and then we lost the connection. Because I make friends with people in China online, I know that I won't come back to China, and probably they don't come to Canada either. If we cannot keep connection online, we really don't have other ways to talk with each other, and I don't want my friends to disappear. So I choose not to speak up in Chinese social medias because things are so weird for me. I still have some names in my mind. We don't know the real name. We only know nicknames for each other. And I hope they are safe. I hope they are happy because I feel really bad that there are so many people supporting Hong Kong, Thailand, Myanmar in China, I guarantee. But they are not being heard. And they can't be heard for different reasons. and a lot of them are very young. They are just like my age. Some of them are even younger than me. And I always tell people that, like, for example, I have some friends in Myanmar. They are isolated. I always tell them, no, there are so many Chinese people care about you. Like, when earthquake happened this year, I have some friends doing fundraising in China. And they can't really post something in public, but we share the news because we share the event information because we have our own circle. And I tell my friends that I have friends doing fundraising for you in China, but I can't really post it too much in public because I hope they are safe. But I feel so bad. Sometimes I have to cut the connection with China but I also feel if I cut the connection with my Chinese friends in China, who will hear them? But I can't go through that again. It's my trauma. I don't know. I just, because I know that they are being watched by the government all the time, but they are still trying to do something. Especially, it's been 2025. A lot of people feel hopeless. They are still doing the same. I was really touched when my friends are doing a fundraising for Myanmar in China because I know it must be really risky. Again and again, I have to just pray for them. Because you need to reach out to people in China, so you must post that on Chinese social medias. But how do you post that in a way that people can reach out, but you don't get danger? It's hard, because I know some people in China, they do activism. It's not even activism. I remember on Women's International Day, there was a screening about films directed by women directors in China. I don't know if that's because they share the information on WeChat groups. They get monitored and they have to cancel that event for some reasons. But also you can't reach out to other people on Instagram or something because it's more and more difficult for Chinese people to use social medias like that. So I think things are so hard. I also know that Myanmar government sometimes cut internet in Myanmar. And I feel like we are not facing that issue, but we have something really similar, that we have internet, but we can't reach out to people. And it's just another way. Because in Myanmar, you can use Instagram or Facebook, but the government cut the internet sometimes. And in China, the government doesn't cut the internet, but you can't use the social medias with more freedom. And you must be watched by the government all the time. And you still want to do something. That's really, really brave, but also very, very dangerous. I admire those people because, to be honest, I don't really think that's something that I can do.
Yeah, it's really hard because in Myanmar, yes, internet is cut off. But when it is not cut off, it is also surveilled. I don't know how, at what level of it. So to use Facebook, Instagram, you still need to use VPN. So Facebook is technically not allowed since the coup, and then they can the police can stop you on the street and ask to take a look at your phone, and if they feel like you are saying things that are radical or against the military, those are arbitrary rules. You could be arrested. You could be in trouble. And yes, there was internet cut off. I think they do this like information blackout whenever something bad is going to happen. So right after the coup happened, and there were marches and people going out on the street to protest. And at some point, we don't have any connection for phone lines and internet in certain areas. That really caused anxiety to me because I couldn't communicate with my family, my friends. So we don't know what kind of bad thing was going to happen. So and also my job as a journalist is very public and very visible. And also I have to watch the footages of things happening. And sometimes it takes the doom scrolling to the next level. I'm bombarded with all the information about the atrocities that's going on in my town, in my country, where I am in a position to report that. So there's always like mixed feelings about it that I struggle with as well. And that's what you said about a trauma in losing your friends and then severing the only connection that you have with them, which is online. And that is a loss and a grief that you go through on top of the grief that you go through for leaving home or standing up for what you believe in or writing on things like, for example, like on Taiwan, but your home country, China, is perpetrator for a lot of things that you stand against. So I can relate, but I can't begin to understand all of it that you go through. And I want to shift our focus to your artist side. You know, you're a student activist and writer, and also you do a lot of visual art. And there is a character that you mention on your website, Super Rabbit Person. And you wrote that character was around when you were a teenager. And then from there, the evolution of that character and into that is continuing into your life, right? Like, so how do you use your artistic abilities and characters to express your feelings and things that you go through with?
Actually, I know many talented activists and artists, they express their activism opinions by their art. I don't do that directly, not because I don't want to, just because I'm not professional, only because I can't do that. It takes me a lot of time to draw an illustration. But I found illustration is a way to make myself calm down. I drew the character, the super rabbit person. It's actually basic myself. You can see that all of my paintings about the rabbit person has the red line on their face. That's actually my tattoo. I sometimes draw the crying rabbit. I sometimes draw the cute rabbit. That's actually the imagination of myself. I found illustration is something that make myself feel peaceful. And although it is really hard because I have never learned drawing, it can express myself in a political way. It is a little bit weird to see that because apparently I'm not someone who's really a politic. But when I do the drawing, I have a feeling that I don't need to have some responsibility. I don't need to express my opinions by my work. So it actually gives me more freedom to talk about my really personal feelings. apparently personal is also a political, and my personal experiences are really related to my political experiences. But I would say it's different to express in a very personal way, because when I do protest or write an article, I always talk about the community as a whole. But when I do driving, it's only about myself. I also do driving related to my dogs. That's just my personal life, but that gives me a space to take a break.
Can you tell me more about your tattoo, the red line? From, because it's you said that it relates you, the character is based on you. And why do you have that tattoo?
Oh, I don't want to sound disappointing, but I actually have this tattoo for fun.
For fun? That sounds exciting. Yeah. When did you have it?
I think 2022 or 2023.
In China?
No, in Canada. I came to here in 2022. I got my tattoo after arriving in Canada, but I don't really remember which year, probably 2023. But I kind of regretful because it causes some trouble, because I need my photo in some documentations, and when I submit my photo, I was always told that your photo is not correct because there is a red line, and I have to explain that, oh, that's my tattoo.
That's a unique problem to have.
Yes. And people ask me, like, do you get hurt or something? And I said, no, that's a tattoo. Yeah, I'm kind of regretful. I think I was just a childish teenager, want to be cool, and I want to be unique, so I did this tattoo.
For our listeners who are just listening to it with the audio, Lorraine, they have this red tattoo from the chin down to the middle of the neck. And that is such a unique a tattoo, which we can see also in the super rapid person character. And with that, I want to go into, you know, the process of expressing your personal feelings and different complicated feelings using art as an outlet. Because like you said, your personal life is political and your political life is personal. And to navigate those waters and to be a transnational person, with the experience that you gather, there is so much to process in yourself when you are relocated to a different place, and when you're studying, and when you're connecting with people from the different community. So thank you for sharing that part of us, part of you with us as well. And then I want to end with one last note on that. One last point I want to go back to is, you know, since you grow up in China and you're still a very let me go back there. Yes. So the last point I want to touch on is to be in this position of creative and also being a very vocal person online, and also having the transnational experience. And you also have a minor in transnational solidarity. That's one of the parts that you mentioned on your website. I want to ask how can people be supportive of these issues? For example, mostly for safety reasons, a lot of people cannot go out and protest. A lot of people cannot put their name or identity online when they try to support these different marginalized issues. And for that, like, how can one become a good ally in supporting that in the limited ways? Like, I'm sure we can in our listeners, right? Like, so people from either from Myanmar or China or in different English speaking country, but also their hearts in the right place and want to support. But even acknowledging that you are listening to these kind of quote unquote radical ideas or pre-democracy ideas could put somebody in a jeopardizing position, right? So how can one surpass that and become a good ally moving forward in supporting these issues?
I would say 2 points. First point is that, as I mentioned before, there are different roles in the movement. Sometimes you don't have to be a public speaker. You can do behind-the-scenes work. You can organize people. You can do graphic design for the social media poster. You can run the social medias. You can do writings, and you don't have to credit your legal name or something. And another point is that more caring to each other. I have some friends, they don't really do activism. They are not as active as I am, but they are very supportive. Whenever I feel depressed, whenever I feel freaking out, I can always reach out to them. I always have some names in my mind that if I feel I feel insecure, I can call them. There are some names in my mind. Those emotional labors are still very important, because a lot of us in the community don't really know how to do self-care, or we have no ability to do self-care. And some people do offer the caring. They are probably not participating in activism very, very actively, but they offer a lot of emotional labor to me. And for me, that's also same important as advocating, because we all know that we are doing a long-term work. It's important to keep strong. And it's not really possible to keep strong alone. You must have some backup, and some people are doing the backup. And I would say if someone feel insecure to do activism, or feel if someone feel I really can't do it, but you can do something for people who are doing this. Yes, probably that you are afraid of going to the street, but you can have a call with your friend who go to the street when you realize that they are not in a good status. And you can always care people who go to the street, and you can always ask them what do they want. You can always have some caring for them. That's not something risky, but also same important.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Insight Myanmar Podcast. Producing these conversations takes dedication and resources. And through this process, we're committed to keeping all these episodes freely available for everyone well into the future. But to really make this work sustainable, we do need your help. If you've enjoyed this episode or found it valuable, and if you listen to our platform on any somewhat regular basis, we ask you to consider supporting us with a recurring donation. It doesn't have to be much. Think of it as, I don't know, buying us a cup of coffee each month. That small gesture of committing to just $5 per month can make a big difference in helping us to continue bringing you these stories. And if you're feeling a bit more generous, increasing the monthly pledge will allow us to produce even more on our end. In the end, any level of support goes directly towards amplifying the voices and stories that matter. this not only keeps us going, but also ensures that these important conversations reach more people around the world. To make a contribution, visit insightmyanmar.org/donation or look for Insight Myanmar on PayPal or Patreon.
Oh, ba, yara nanda, yara nanga, 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 yara nanga